Morning. Welcome once again to By Grace. I'm really thrilled that you're all here to worship with us this morning, whether you're joining us here in person or on the live stream. Sometimes I think about our church service and I say, you know, I bet it's easily perceived as not serious, that we don't take our worship very serious because we delight in little kids, and we want them to come to the Lord as he wants. Sometimes you can hear a cry and be distracted. Sometimes you can see a little girl twirling or a little boy twirling and crawling around, and it can be a distraction, no doubt. But it's also a reminder to me that as the people of God, we love all of the people here. And one of the things we can do is encourage the mom who you can see is frail and at her wit's end. We can also remember that if we are distracted by the wee ones among us and it causes us to refocus, let our refocus be that the Lord has even more patience with me than I must have with them. Sound good? But make no mistake, there might be some informalities to what we do, but we are very serious about the Lord, very serious about his word. And so I remind us every week, and I will do so again today as we continue our sermon series in 2 Samuel chapter 10, that this is God's word and that we should hear it as the very words of God and receive it as the very words of God. 2 Samuel chapter 10, beginning in verse 1. After this, the king of the Ammonites died, and Hanun, his son, reigned in his place. And David said, I will deal loyally with Hanun, the son of Nahash, and his father dealt loyally with me. So David sent by his servants to console him concerning his father, and David's servants came into the land of the Ammonites, but the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun, their lord, do you think because David has sent comforters to you that he is honoring your father? Has not David sent his servants to you to search the city and to spy it out and to overthrow it? So Hanun took David's servants and shaved off half the beard of each and cut off their garments in the middle at their hips and sent them away. When it was told David, he sent to meet them, for the men were greatly ashamed. And the king said, remain at Jericho until your beards have grown and then return. When the Ammonites saw that they had become a stench to David, the Ammonites sent and hired the Syrians of Beth Rehob and the Syrians of Zobah, 20,000 foot soldiers, and the king of Maacah with 1,000 men, and the men of Tob, 12,000 men. And when David heard of it, he sent Joab and all the host of the mighty men. And the Ammonites came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the gate. And the Syrians of Zobah and Rahab and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the open country. When Joab saw that the battle was set against him both in front and in the rear, he chose some of the best men of Israel and arrayed them against the Syrians. The rest of his men he put in the charge of Abishai, his brother, and he arrayed them against the Ammonites. And he said, if the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I will come and help you. Be of good courage, and let us be courageous for our people and for the cities of our God. And may Yahweh do what seems good to him. So Joab and the people who were with him drew near to the battle against the Syrians, and they fled before him. And when the Ammonites saw that the Syrians fled, they likewise fled before Abishai and entered the city. Then Joab returned from fighting against the Ammonites and came to Jerusalem. But when the Syrians saw that they'd been defeated by Israel, they gathered themselves together. and Hadazer sent and brought out the Syrians who were beyond the Euphrates. They came to Helam with the Shobak, the commander of the army of Hadadezer, at their head. And when it was told David, he gathered all Israel together and crossed the Jordan and came to Helam. The Syrians arrayed themselves against David and fought with him. But the Syrians fled before Israel, and David killed of the Syrians the men of 700 chariots and 40,000 horsemen, and wounded Shobak, the commander of their army, so that he died there. And when all the kings who were servants of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and became subject to them. So the Syrians were afraid to save the Ammonites anymore. Please pray with me. O Lord our God, we are here gathered. We are gathered to know you. We're gathered to praise you. We're gathered that you might speak to us through your word, that we would be renewed. Renewed in strength, renewed in focus. Father, that you would stir faith in us. God, we ask this morning that you would give us eyes to see you and your ways, to give us ears that we might hear your voice among all the other voices in our lives, and that we might yield before you, that we might glorify Christ and not ourselves, that we may seek your honor above our own. It's in Jesus' name that we ask these things, and all God's people agree. As we've been working our way through 1 Samuel and now 2 Samuel, we've seen many glimpses of the Messiah that is promised to Israel. We've seen many foreshadowing moments. We've seen many truths that reveal God's character to his people. Last week, we spent our time looking at the kindness of God's kingdom. We referred to it, hopefully affectionately, as the Hesed way. Yes? The Hesed way. Hesed being the Hebrew word here that is sometimes tough to translate because it's so filled, pregnant, if you will, with meaning and understanding. It's talking about loving kindness and covenant loyalty. So when we talk about the Hesed way, we're talking about living in the shadow of the cross. We're talking about living in light of all that God has done in us, for us, and desires and will do through us. So last week we saw David's love for Jonathan, David's Hesed way, poured out in an heir of Saul and Jonathan. It's a son of Jonathan, Mephibosheth. And we saw, by the time our time together had concluded, that we are the Lord's Mephibosheth, right? That just as Mephibosheth experienced an incredibly undeserved affection from David, we too know what it means that the Lord has that kind of kindness for us, that kind of covenant loyalty and faithfulness poured out in our lives. Well, this chapter, just like last chapter, is going to be connected because of the Hesed way. You'll see this word Hesed pop forth for us here in verse 2. So let's remember as we come in that the events of this chapter actually take place earlier in the book of Samuel than we have it recorded. Thematically, it fits perfectly here, but chronologically, these events took place before. So if you're hearing names and thinking to yourself, that guy's dead, or haven't we seen him before, but not in this context? The answer is yes, absolutely. Because the chronology here is not the link, it's the theme. It is the Hesed way towards others. In fact, when we see David as king, part of what we are understanding is the way that God's kingdom is designed to be. Now, again, is Israel going to be a perfect expression of God's kingdom? No, like emphatically no. In fact, the next two chapters are part of our deep understanding of why it's not perfect, because its king is not perfect. And so we're going to see that David has these political policies. Internally, we saw it towards Mephibosheth, and now we're going to see foreign policy. But the Hesed way is the policy, regardless of the audience, whether they be an insider who's an enemy by birth and bloodline, or whether it's an outsider who has no share of the kingdom and yet has been kind or loyal to David before. So as we see the Hesed way, we must understand that it is the ideal and design, but it will be imperfectly applied until the true king of Israel has come and his kingdom is ruled in his own perfections. But that day is not now in this story. So we see, after the king of the Ammonites had died and Hanun, his son, reigned in his place, you see that families are often the next bearer of the dynasty, right? If you're going to be king in a place and you die, the most likely person to take your throne is your own kin, usually a son or an oldest son. Here, that's the custom and pattern that's followed. The son takes his father's place. In verse 2, we read, David said, I will deal loyally, that's Hesed, with Hanun, the son of Nahash, as his father dealt loyally with me. So we don't have a record of them having a formal treaty. We don't really know what the loyalty was that David was first shown. What we see in the follow-up, the reaction, the continuance of whatever brotherhood and intimacy was established. So here, David is extending this loving kindness, this covenant loyalty, to the new monarch as he takes his father's throne. Notice, we read in verse 2, the purpose for David's sending of his servants could not be clearer. David sends his lackeys, his servants, to console the son in the hour of his father's death. This is great custom. This is appropriate reaction and action. But we also know that anytime there's a regime change, anytime there's a new son rising to power, the old ways, the old customs, the old patterns might be changed, but certainly at least examined. And there's a lot of people who seek to fill the power vacuum in moments like this. The Bible's filled with these, yes? Our histories are filled with this. This isn't just a Near Eastern reality, yes? That when there's political turnover and power, people move into that power vacuum thinking that maybe they can have a larger share of that power than they had before. Sometimes that's good ambition. Not all ambition is bad. But two factors must accompany it. The first is, why are you ambitious? For whose good? For the people's good that you would care well for them? Or for your good, your wealth, your power, your fame? And the second that goes with it is not just your purpose, but also your methodology in wanting to fill that power void, in wanting to have a response of ambition. Your methodologies are every bit as important as your purpose. Why do you want to take power? And how do you take this power? This is where evil often lurks, looms, hides, or can be clearly seen. So here, David is sending his followers, his leaders, to console this son whose father has passed. And as they come, their intentions are good, their compassion real. But the lackeys are abuzz. And they're abuzz in this pursuit of their own power. We see this with the but beginning in verse 3. But the princes of the Ammonites said to their new king, their new lord, "Do you think because David has sent comforters to you that he's honoring your father?" Sometimes it's the tone of the question, right? Their question is not, "Oh, look at David, that's so nice." It's suspicion. Suspicion of villainy. And their skepticism, we're told, is unfounded. David sent comforters to comfort, but they are viewed as spies who, in their treachery, seek to figure out the weaknesses of the security systems that are in place so that we can conquer the king. As an aside, I'm in fourth grade. I'm sitting in class, and the teacher asks us to write a small few sentences about what you want to do when you grow up. And all the things that you should expect, right? Like teacher, nurse, fireman, doctor, astronaut, president. Like, there was plenty of that in the room. But, like, that stuff never really interested me. And to my mom's great horror, I imagine, as she's here in the room listening, I wrote bank robber. As you would expect. I'm in fourth grade. And my dad had showed me one of my favorite heist movies. That was one of his favorite heist movies. And the reason I said bank robber was not because I wanted to steal other people's money or because I knew insurance would take care of whatever losses or whatever, whatever. I thought it was the greatest problem-solving job on the planet. The enemy, the bank, has resources allocated, cameras and people. And in the heist movie, if man makes a defense system, there's always a way to get into it, right? There's always a way to get through it. If man made it, man can unmake it. So my dad, who loved logic and logic puzzles, would enjoy with me as I watched the movie, pausing it on occasion to say, "How do you get around that?" He was not training a bank robber, I think. Yeah, it didn't work. And the irony is I actually worked as a bank teller later in life. I didn't tell them this part. But the reality was it was a problem to be solved. It was security measures to understand and figure out. And sometimes the heist goes poorly because they had a defense you didn't know about. And sometimes it goes smoothly because you knew everything that you were up against. So here the lackeys of this new and young king are saying, these guys are not here to comfort you. It's a ruse. They want to see and spy out our defenses so that they can come overthrow us. Where's the weakness in our walls? Where's the weakness in our armory? How do they get through our defenses and conquer us? And let's be honest. We have recently seen how the Lord has led David to interact with conquered peoples. You remember that really hard sermon not so long ago? So I think there is a reasonable fear here that conquered peoples are vulnerable. And a fear against that kind of vulnerability can be very reasonable. But here it's unfounded. And the author is telling us that at the jump. David intended to send comforters to console. They came consoling, but they were perceived wrongly. Have you ever been perceived wrongly? Have you ever received injustice when you are innocent? Somebody impugns your motives, tells you that there's a different reason for your intentions. It's personally hurtful, yes? To have people no longer trust your word, believe you when you say, I am here for this reason and not that reason. I wish to do or not do out of a clear conscience. They come in peace. And they are perceived as enemies, not welcomed as friends or partners. So this Hesed way is about to lead to the humiliation and disgrace of God's servants. Anyone who tells you if you would just trust God, everything will be smooth and clean and easy is selling you something. The blood of Christ is free to us, costly to him. But they think it's a scam. So what's their reaction to this perceived duplicity? They convince Hanan that David's servants come to seek, to study, and to eventually overthrow. So Hanan gathers, arrests David's servants, and shaves off half the beard of each. Let's deal with part one. Hi. What happened to you this week? You oopsed when you were cutting your beard, yes? This moment stinks. If you grow a beard and you oops, everyone knows. Harold, I don't think I've ever seen you mostly clean shaven before. He loves his beard. I have total man jealousy of his beard. But today, my beard's bigger than yours. And yes, I can be that petty. I love you too, brother. And in like a minute, you'll have more than me and I'll be jealous again. Was there a tiny little piece of your heart, and I kid you not, we did not plan this. Is there a tiny little piece of your heart that felt ashamed or disgraced? This is not how you want to present yourself. It's not how you commonly present yourself. Hey, ladies, how much money do you spend in a year on your hair? Don't answer. How much are the right dryers or curlers or straightening irons? How much is it to go and get it blown out? We have a wedding in our near future as a congregation, yes? How many of you are scurrying to make your plans as we speak about who's going to do your hair and when is it going to be done and how is it going to be done? And fellas, make your hair look like what they want. Right? It's a great gift a groom can give to his bride or his bride's mother. Love you. This video is definitely going to get taken down. Are you getting this? We care about our presentation. We care about our looks. We care about how others perceive us. This chapter is so easy to read through and ignore completely. And yet it's critical for us to understand that all these times we read about war and we don't get many details, there's heart and soul and blood and sweat and tears associated with every word because every event here mattered deeply, profoundly. It's worth recording for all of history. Sometimes it's easy for us to look at these events and move little plastic figurines on a fake board in our minds. These guys are here, and that's this city, and that's over here, and that's how it took place. Without understanding that these are real people who deal in real situations. They are humiliated because half their beard was shaved off. So Harold, we return to you for but a moment more. Did you oops everywhere? You oopsed in one place, And what did you feel like you had to do? Take it all. Take it all. The humiliation here is that they shaved off half their beard, thereby forcing the other men to either shave off the rest or to regrow it for so long that people would not see their face and know the difference. But that's not the only thing that happened. If you have little kids, this is a moment to give them earmuffs. Because the other humiliation that these men suffered was that their clothes were cut. I love how gently this is translated for us. Oh, they were cut in the middle. You know, where your hips are. Well, our hips are not, if you need the visual, here. Right, Micah? I'm right on this one. Our hips are not here, but more like here, right? If I was to, and I won't. You with me? They got sent home, let's go with pantsless. Commando. And they have to walk home. Half bearded and naked from the waist down. Shame, humiliation, disgrace. Because they obeyed a righteous king's righteous command? How many of you think I should never be humiliated because I'm a child of the king? Nothing should go bad for me because I love Jesus and he loves me. So there shouldn't be any shame in my life. There shouldn't be any difficulty in my life. There shouldn't be any embarrassment, disgrace, suffering. Yeah, tell that to these guys. Tell that to our Lord who warns us that if they hate you, remember they hated me first. Jesus says that on the eve of his crucifixion. He says, take heart, I've overcome the world. Yes, and yet humiliation and disgrace will linger. And sometimes it's our fault, can we agree? Sometimes our humiliation is on us. My sin, my stupidity, my lack of foresight, my bad intentions. But sometimes my disgrace, my humiliation is someone else's sin. It's the result of someone else's actions that I could not protect myself from and have to live in and with. This is where the gospel must reach us. How does the Hesed way respond to this kind, to this degree of humiliation and disgrace? They were forced to walk home with half a beard and none of their clothes, or only the upper half of their clothes. Verse 5, David found out. I love this moment. It's so innocuous. David hears of their disgrace, and he doesn't react with anger first. He goes to meet with the men. He doesn't just hear of the evil. He doesn't just hear of the plan and the vindictive response to this innocent and generously comforting desire that David has. He does not think war before he sees their humiliation and moves into it. Will there be battle as a result of this? Yep. But that's not his first reaction. His first reaction is to move to the victims. How awesome is it that we have a God who sees us and moves to us in the hardest places, in the deepest hurts, because he will not let us be alone in those moments. Christian, hear me. You are not alone in your suffering. David doesn't leave these guys alone. And he doesn't want to hear the tale. He wants to comfort the victims who experienced this unexpected but profound disgrace, that they might know that they're free to come to his presence. How many times do you think I gotta get myself ready before I can be with God? How many times do I think I can't come to church with curlers in my hair? How many times do we think if we don't put on our best clothes, we won't be welcomed at church or in the throne room of heaven? Y'all. He moves to us in the middle of our disgrace, whether it's our fault or somebody else's. He sees the tenderness of those moments and enters into it. And there will be vengeance and reprisal, and all those things will come. But first, there's the ministry of presence. Then there'll be the ministry of action. David, he sent to meet with them, for the men were greatly ashamed. And the king commands, remain at Jericho until your beards have grown, and then return. Is he saying that because he doesn't want them to come to Israel to be a part of the people of God? No, he's saying that for their dignity's restoration. They're free to return whenever they want. But what he's saying is, I'll fit the bill for you to remain here until you want to present yourself in public again. Because it's more than their beard that needs to be dealt with. He gives them time to deal with their trouble. These guys are deeply ashamed, greatly ashamed. But one of the things that we must remember as believers today, in this moment, we must acknowledge and embrace the reality that just because a humiliation is temporary, it does not mean that the disgrace or shame won't last. You with me? Just because the humiliation is temporary doesn't mean the disgrace or shame won't last. One of the things we must embrace in order to love each other well is that cruelty lingers. You with me? Cruelty lingers. It lingers in the heart. It lingers in the mind. There are times in our lives where we are tempted to say to little ones or peers or even those older than us, get over it. Right? Get over it. We have a lady in our church I love who says sometimes, rightly, she doesn't misuse this, but she says it rightly, suck it up, buttercup. And there are moments and things where that's a good response. It's a good encouragement. This is, you're making a bigger deal out of this than you need to. But there are times where we want to make a smaller deal out of something that happened than the person does, than the victim does. May we never be a place where the victims are shamed further. Yeah? Sometimes cruelty lingers. Lingers in the heart. It lingers in the mind. It makes you not want to go or do. It can be paralyzing. It doesn't have to be paralyzing. But let's acknowledge that it can be. I was talking with a counselor this summer, my counselor this summer, and we were talking about shame, and we were talking about maybe there's a holy side to shame. That's for another sermon. But I asked her, what do you do to help somebody who's hidden away in shame? It's a good question, right? Try and have good questions. What do you do to help someone who is hidden away in shame? And her response, I hope I never forget. You take the light of the gospel to them and sit with them until what they see is more light than dark. and then you walk out of that place together? How many of you want the people in the church around you to be able to do that for you, to sit with you, to preach the gospel to you and remain with you in your shame, in your disgrace, in your humiliation, until you either don't see it as humiliation anymore, or you're willing to take that to the cross, receive all the mercy and forgiveness that is necessary so that you can return to life in a deeper and better way? Don't you guys want to bear the torch for one another? Don't you want to bear the torch to your neighbor? Not so that they can come to church, but so they can come to Christ. Remain is the command. The purpose is freedom and grace and light. So we move to verse 6, and it's important now to see the structural differences in this passage here. What happens in verse 6, 9, 14, 15, and 19 is keyed off the word saw, or the verb to see. I'll show you. Verse 6, when the Ammonites saw that they had become a stench to David, you think? David has an odious sense when he looks at you and thinks about you. Why? Because you disgraced his servants, those who serve in his high court. You humiliated. You think he's going to have a stench towards you? Yeah. So here's the crisis. The crisis is that the Ammonites saw that they were a stench, and it led them to an action. And you're going to see that happen 5 times in this passage. 6, 9, 14, 15, 19. You're going to see a crisis, and the people in the crisis are going to recognize the crisis, and then that will lead them to an action. This is the literary structure of the passage that follows. So the Ammonites now know that there's hostility between them and David, you think? So what did they do? They hire mercenaries. That's their response. They see the problem that they created. They woke a giant, if you'll forgive the pun. No, sorry, the giant slayer. What's the next response? They got to hire mercenaries. They have to get all of these other tribes and people groups, all these other warlords and tribes to gather together to give what they have, soldiers and chariots and horsemen and others, because there's going to be a reprisal for the humiliation of God's people. There will be judgment as a response to their infidelity, to their rebellion, to their treachery. And that's why we get this list of soldiers and armies and people groups. So this chapter is very much about war. But what's remarkable to me is that there's so much war in this chapter that's undetailed. Right? Like, this would be an awesome movie, just this chapter. Be an awesome movie. You've got politics and policy. You've got the chess pieces of different armies moving and fixated in different plays. Where do we need the horsemen? Where are the chariots? Where are the soldiers and the bowmen and others? And yet we get virtually none of that. We get the political allying, and we get one detailed pincer move. Where are my war lovers? Oh, don't raise your hand. You'll get judged. Who loves a war movie? You guys know what a pincer move is? It's awesome. And it's super effective. Because you can't just fight front to back, right? You put certain, there's convention to war. In case you didn't know this, I'm going to give you a 101. So in a battle, you have people, and this will shock you, at the front of the battle. And then you're going to have people at the rear of the battle, and then you're gonna have people in between. Isn't this profound? You with me? Maybe that's why they didn't detail this that much. It's a pincer move. when you don't let your enemy work just front to back against you. They have to go front to back to front against you. Pincer move puts you in two battle formations, one from the front and one from the rear. And what it means is you basically cut your army in half to deal with it. Because half the guys that you would normally have up front have to go to the far rear to make a new front. Are you with me? So we get this detailed pincer move. This is what Joab's going to see in verse 9. Joab saw, again, keyword, saw, that the battle was set against him both in front and in the rear. So he chose some of the best men of Israel and arrayed them against the Syrians. The rest of his men he put in the charge of Abishai, his brother, and he arrayed them against the Ammonites. So you have the Syrians on one battlefront and the Ammonites on the other battlefront, and the two brothers are heading up half the army. But there's something I forgot to say, and that is verse 7. When David heard of the loyalty and contracts being negotiated with his enemies as they gather together to come against him, he sent Joab and who? Oh, come on, y'all. This is the fun part. Who? The mighty men. Welcome to the party. These guys are killers. They're generals. They're war heroes. These guys are hardened in battle. Some of them might even have a little twinge of bloodthirst. You kind of need that when you're hand-to-hand combat. These are not ordinary soldiers. These are not farmers with pitchforks that are going to go to battle. You mess with Israel. David has spent 12 years fighting with these men. 12 years against odds bigger than them, armies much bigger than them, technology at a disadvantage. These guys find victory over and over and over again. Why? Because God is with them. But these are the mighty men that are arrayed. So Joab sees all of the civilizations around them seeking their destruction and defeat. And he says to his brother, you take half, I'll take half, we'll be fine. But, verse 11, if the Syrians are too strong for me, then you shall help me. Does that need to be said? It's a little weird, right? Like if we're losing on one front, we will lose the whole thing. So it's a little weird, but it is helpful to understand their expectation of this pincer move. So if the Syrians are too strong for me, you shall help me. If the Ammonites are too strong for you, then I'll come and help you. And then he says the most important verse in the whole chapter. Be of good courage. All right, yeah, battle, right? You always need a speech. You ever see a war movie without a speech? You ever see a war movie where the big main good guy who's totally got his back against the wall, think Braveheart, right? He's running back and forth on the horse, and he's firing everybody up, right? Isn't that what good leaders do? So he's firing them up. Verse 12, be of good courage. Let us be courageous for our people. Remember, we're doing this for our wives and our children and our legacy. Be of good courage. Be courageous for our people. Do this for the cities of our God. And may Yahweh do what seems good to him. It almost seems like the good speech stopped and this sobering reality kicked in. Right? I mean, Braveheart, like he's not, William Wallace is not saying that. He's not like, okay, guys, get excited, fight. Remember we have nobility here. Remember the stakes. Remember the purpose. Remember who we're defending. God is on our side. Go get them! Remember, God is on our side, and he'll determine the victor. It seems to be a letdown at first blush. But is it? I want you to hear this phrase. It's the most important part of this whole chapter. May Yahweh do what seems good to him. One of the commentators asked this question. I love this question. Is this foxhole religion? Right? Are these the things that you say to yourself and others when your back is up against the wall and you're like, ooh, I should probably add God into this situation. I should probably pull God out of the little cigar box I normally tuck him into, play with him a little bit so that I can feel calm, and maybe I'll get some inspiration from that. And then I'll put the lid on him and stick him back in the sock drawer where I store him most of the time. Foxhole religion. Love that. My reaction is usually, is that bumper sticker? Is that bumper sticker theology? The kind of stuff you slap in public, but that you don't keep in your heart? Is that the kind of 10-word phrase that you say to everybody but yourself? I don't think that's what's happening. I think Joab is really deeply committed to this reality, that God does what he pleases, and what we want is for him to do good in this situation. Whatever's good by his definition, that's what I want. Ask yourself, Christian, is that true of you on a Tuesday morning? That you want whatever God says is good today to happen? Or do you have a better plan that you want to let God in on? Don't you have a great plan for your life? Joab is not promised specific victory today. He's not. And in fact, of all the people in Israel who could say something this deep, this profound, that cuts through all the superstition, it's Joab? We've seen him before, right? This is a hardened warrior without much empathy, it seems. You get it? How does the unlikely spokesman deliver the best truth in the whole chapter? Because God. Let this be our firm solace. Let this be our tremendous comfort. Listen to the civil rights activist and Baptist minister, Ralph Abernathy. He says this. He says, I don't know what the future may hold, but I know who holds the future. Isn't that great? I don't know what the future may hold, but I know who holds the future. Is it not very similar to what Corrie Ten Boom has said? The great Corrie Ten Boom, she says this, never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God. Right? Isn't that us? Isn't that what we believe? Isn't that what we herald? Isn't that what we have to offer our friends and our neighbors and our loved ones? You do not need to be afraid. It doesn't guarantee victory. It doesn't prevent all shame and disgrace. What it does is align us with the deepest truth of creation. That whatever God says is good for us. Isn't that what we believe? Doesn't that pierce through our superstitions? Doesn't that penetrate our bumper sticker theology? I don't think this is foxhole religion. I think this is sanctification. I think what's happening here is that Joab understands that sometimes Israel wins and sometimes Israel loses, but it never loses God because God cannot be lost. Wherever he gives himself, he remains and brings to completion all that he begins. And that's what you see unfold in the rest of this chapter. The rest of this chapter is people seeing and people fleeing, people seeing, and then there's going to be a bigger army. Verse 15 is important. When the Syrians saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they gathered themselves together. That's not a nice thing. This is actually menacing. We don't translate it menacingly, right? It sounds like they're like cuddling afterwards, licking their wounds. That's not what happens. They're actually going to build a bigger Aramean army. And David's going to have to deal with that towards the end of chapter 12. Verse 15 is a precursor to the threat that follows the Bathsheba and Uriah situation we'll walk into next week. Verse 19, when all the kings of all these other tribes who were servants of Hadadezer saw that they had been defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and became subject to them. So much so that the Syrians were afraid to save the Ammonites anymore. One army defeated on this day. But there'll be more battles. There'll be more wars. There'll be more pincer moves. Dale Ralph Davis says this. He says, in spite of all resistance and hostility, the Davidic king will rule. They might win a battle, they might lose a battle, but whatever the outpouring is, the reality will always remain that Israel and those who are hostile to Israel will all be ruled by the Davidic king fully, completely, and eternally. So I'm going to quote myself, if you'll allow me. Not really sure what you could do to stop me. Maybe boo. Let's not do that. We may never know the outcome of any particular circumstance, but if the Lord will do what seems good to him, I never need fear. For he has pledged to his people that the good he intends for any situation is also for my good. I don't journal that often, but I thought that one was pretty good. What's the most important here? The Hesed way is good policy. It's good policy domestically. It's good policy in foreign interactions. But it must be the governing principle of the Christian's way of life. That we are to give kindness, to be loyal and generous, faithful, even when others shame us, disgrace us, humiliate us. We will let the Lord judge those things. And we will bear the torch of the gospel with one another to call us from shame into newness of life. Amen? Please pray with me. Heavenly Father, we ask you to meet with us. We ask you to sear on our hearts your very word. May we truly believe that what you seem to see as good is good. May you define good for us. May you forgive us our shames that are our fault. Would you remove from us our disgraces that are our fault? But also, Lord, would you come and meet with us in such a way and to such a degree that those shames and humiliations that are not our fault, would you sit with us in them and take the shame from them? Would you come and meet with us in the dark moments so that our declarations are not bumper sticker faith, but the real thing? Come, Lord, if you can use Joab to speak truth to me and to Israel, how much more can you speak truth to me through Jesus Christ? Come that I might see all things with your eyes. Come that I might hope for all good that you have to be poured out in our life, both now and forever. Come, O Lord, and empower your people to love and live as you have called us to do. May the Hesed road be our path forever. And all God's people agree.